We're ready for Galatians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. In the last class, we stopped with Galatians chapter 4 and verse 7. Paul was talking to the Galatians about the fact that they were spiritual heirs. They had found the truth. They were going to receive everything that Christ had for them as far as this life and in the next if they would stay faithful to the course. But they were at risk of throwing everything away by following the false teachers. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody throw anything away in the sense of, I mean, not the trash, but I mean, they had worked for something, they had labored for something, and they had hoped that at some point, you know, they'd be able to enjoy the fruits of the labors for so forth. One of the greatest examples for me, and it doesn't compare with what you have in Galatians, but it stuck with me over the years. There was a fellow who had at least 18 years in the military. 20 years would have been the retirement point. He became involved with the Jehovah's Witnesses. They convinced him that serving the military was wrong. So he filed the paperwork, actually, because of the job I had, actually processed the paperwork to some degree. At least I looked at it. And the fella allowed the Jehovah's Witnesses to craft a case, and he got out of the military because he filed what was really a conscientious objection. And he lost his retirement. He went that long. He went almost the full course, and then he threw it away because of what the Jehovah's Witnesses had taught him. And I thought, wow, how sad, how unfortunate. And that's kind of what the Galatians were at risk of doing. I mean, they were risking their own souls, risking every spiritual benefit, because they wanted to go back and to find justification through the law. Well, that brings us to Galatians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9, where Paul said, "Howbeit at that time, not knowing God," he's talking about the Galatians, he says, "you were in bondage to them that by nature are no gods. But now that ye have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how turn ye back again to the weak and beggarly rudiments whereunto ye desire to be in bondage over again?" When you look at that expression, not knowing God, it is expressed with a perfect tense, and that is another reminder of how these readers were Gentiles. If they had been Jews, they would have known the one true God, but these people had come from an idolatrous kind of background. And that's why Paul says that you were in bondage. You were in this spiritual bondage. You were in bondage to those, he says, that are no gods. You're in bondage to the false gods. You have a similar thing back there in Acts chapter 17 and verse 30. Remember, Paul is in the area of Athens, and as he's coming into the city, he's able to see all the idols, and he says, "I perceive that you are very religious." Religion is throughout your city. You have all kinds of statues, all kinds of gods, but they are false gods. One source said, and I like the quote, he said, "Idols are no more powerful than scarecrows in a cucumber patch." And that about sums it up. We've already seen this point to some degree back there in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 3, but you still have people in the world who are ignorant of this fact, that they are in bondage to Satan, that they are in bondage to spiritual darkness, and that takes a lot of different forms. You can point to people who may be involved with astrology. There are people who feel like their fate is guided by the stars. Back when we had newspapers, you can find it on the web now. People will say, okay, I'm going to have a good day, bad year. We do that somewhat jokingly when we go to a Chinese restaurant. You get the fortune cookie. Sometimes people want to open up the fortune cookie and see what the fortune says, and we make comments about that. I don't think anybody really believes that from a Christian perspective, but there's superstition, there's ignorance in a lot of different ways. You find that in ancient times, people thought that the wind might speak to them, or the different elements, the sun held sway over people. You can find that back in the Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 44, verses 9 through 17, even in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 14, verses 11 through 13. Paul does not deny the fact that there were people, in fact, he specifically admits it, that there were people who were in bondage to this kind of stuff, but he does not associate any kind of power with it. I'll say a little bit more about that spiritual ignorance, unless there's anything that you want to add or ask. Okay, let's go back and look at it just a little bit more. For the pagans, you have, and this is true in the Bible specifically, if you look at Acts chapter 14, verses 11 through 13, you have two false gods mentioned there, Jupiter and Mercury. In our country, we have a growing number of people who are interested in that kind of stuff. But when you think about the ancient world, the bondage that they were held in, if you are surrounded by heathen temples, and many were, especially in the larger cities, if you are surrounded by heathen priests, you can smell the sacrifices, you can see the meat that's being taken to the priests and so forth. When the city has a feast to an idol, again, that's going to affect you in some ways. There's going to be traffic. You're going to see things taking place in the city that probably would not be taking place. Jesus, though, came to liberate people from that kind of thing. You may remember from John chapter 8 and verse 32, Jesus talked about the truth and how that frees people. So these false teachers, they were convincing the Galatians to turn from a position, or posture, you might say, of strength, truth, and power to a posture that was weak, that was not going to be one that could save them from sin, and a state of condemnation. Galatians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. In our day and time, we still have a lot of people who are in spiritual bondage, and that bondage robs them a lot of things. Sometimes it robs them of possessions, their property, their wealth. It robs them of their time. Most importantly, they are separated from the one true God. In this same chapter, backing up a little bit to Galatians 4 and verse 4, Paul said that Jesus was sent into the world at just the right time. And that involves all kinds of things. We talked about some of those things as far as the roads, transportation, the peace that existed. But another thing that had to exist was the level of spiritual darkness in the world, that people simply did not know God. But Paul said, look, Jesus has come, the gospel has been given, so that you could know God, and what else? As you look at here in the first part of verse 9, that you have come to know God and also to be known by God. What's that latter part mean? You are known by God. Galatians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. You're known by God. What's that mean? Doesn't God know everybody? Is there anybody he doesn't know?
It means that they're saved.
All right. It means that they are approved of God. It means that they are in a right relationship with God, that they are pleasing to God. We talked last time about Galatians chapter 4 and verse 6. The Spirit was sent into the hearts of Christians to attest to the fact that they are indeed the children of God. Paul made a similar point to the Corinthians as far as being known by God, 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 3. And Jesus also talked about that in John chapter 10, verses 3 and 27. Here you have these Christians. They have come to the truth. They have received all the spiritual blessings in Christ. They have really gotten in the know, so to speak. And yet, as Paul talks to them and talks about them, what's he say as you look at verse 9? It's the middle of the verse. Now that you've come to know God, or rather be known by God, how possibly can you do what? How can you, what's that key word?
Turn.
How can you turn again? How can you turn back? Now, that's an interesting word, because several times in the New Testament, especially in the book of Acts, and it's not being used that way here, but many times in the book of Acts, you have this word being used to describe conversion. When you think about conversion and a turning, what's really involved? If someone is going to turn to Christ, truly turn to Christ as the Bible describes it, what's that mean in terms of conversion? Is that a big thing? Is that a small thing? Is that a big thing or is that a small thing? That's a big thing. And you also have a big thing here. What has Paul just said about the previous way of life? He says, howbeit at that time, number one, you didn't know God. And in addition to not knowing God, you were in bondage. And that bondage was caused by what kind of spiritual power? Those that were not God's. You were under a state of delusion. It was an illusion for you. And now he says, you're doing what? You're turning back to the time that you didn't know God. How could you possibly think that that's a good thing? How can you believe that that is possibly right? Well, that made no sense whatsoever. Paul expands on that a little bit. He says that stuff that you were involved in, he says it was weak. Those things were the beggarly elements, and they produced bondage. Now, the interesting thing here, and it's kind of a two-part point, as he describes the turning back, it is expressed with the present tense. So if this is ongoing, what does that tell you, or what does that not tell you? If someone says, let's talk about going to the store. I have been to the store. What's that mean? All right, past tense. I am going to the store. What's that mean?
Present tense.
Well, that's true. Can we expand on that a bit? I am going to the store. I am in the I'm in the process of going to the store. So when Paul says you're turning back to this old way of life, does it tell us that that process has been completed?
No.
No. Does it tell us that that process has never been started?
Yes.
Let me ask my question again. Does turning back tell us that the process has not yet begun? If they're turning back,
It has begun.
It's not complete, but it has started. So that tells you, it gives you a little insight as far as where the Galatians were and why Paul throughout this book is fighting so hard to head these Christians back in the right way. You have, let's see if there's anything you want to add or ask. I think there's a couple of hands. Sherman?
Yeah, New King James Version, it uses the word desire, so it's more than just an action. It was something that was in their heart.
I'm headed right there now.
Well,
But that's a great point. So they're not just turning back, but they have the desire, they have the will, they have the interest to turn back as well. Now that's really curious, because if you skip ahead a little bit, let's take a look at Galatians chapter 5 and verse 1. For freedom, notice that word. For freedom did Christ set us free. Stand fast, therefore. Again, this turning that we're talking about here in Galatians 4, 8, and 9, don't do it. Stand fast, therefore, and be not entangled again in a yoke of bondage. Then moving down to verse 13, Galatians chapter 5, for brethren, you were called for freedom. There's that word again. Only use not your freedom for an occasion of the flesh, but through love be servants one to another. Paul is telling them you are about to risk everything. You're losing everything if you continue this process, and you actually desire to do that. You have to wonder just how persuasive these apostates were to convince these guys to put everything on the line and to start forsaking everything on the line. One source said, pointing out what you mentioned a moment ago as far as a Galatians desire, somebody who's really good at the Greek text, he said this was more than mere desire. He says they were bent, B-E-N-T. They were bent on going back to bondage. If you were talking to somebody in the spiritual realm where they had left behind, I mean, it would be like somebody who comes to America. They have oppression in their country. There is high crime. There is no hope. Things are so bad that they have to flee. They come to America and they get a job. They're able to establish a business. They have a successful family. They are safe. They have all the things that they didn't have in their old country. And then one day, their hearts start going back to the country where everything was an absolute disaster. And they say, we really want to go back. This is really important to us. This looks like the best kind of life over there in disaster land. We'd be thinking, what's going on? How can you reason in that way? That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And that's precisely what the Galatians were in the process of doing. And that's why Paul's kind of scratching his head a little bit and saying, I just don't get it. What's so attractive about that system? You know, it didn't work. Justification by keeping the law perfectly, that has never been successful as far as an outcome, and you're going to fail as well. Now, if you were a Gentile, Paul's words are pretty strong. But what happens if you were a Jew, or at least from a Jewish background, and you were reading Paul's words? Do you think they would have stung? I mean, this was like a couple slaps across the face. When he goes back and he starts talking about the beggarly elements, the law was weak, the law couldn't save, you probably would have possibly considered this an insult. And if you look ahead a little bit, I believe it's Galatians chapter 4 and verse 16, yeah, he says, so then am I become your enemy by telling you the truth? This was pretty stiff stuff for him to say, but he's pulling out all the stops to try to help them understand where they are. When you look at the word which is translated weak, it's an adjective. It meant weak or powerless. One source said it described a sick person who has no power or strength. Maybe you've been in that position as far as someone who is ill. You get sick. Some people went through that with COVID. You can barely get out of bed, barely turn over. Everything hurts. That's what Paul says as far as a comparison to the systems, both for the Jews and the Gentiles, that they've been using for religion prior to the Christian era. The religion of the Jews, it had been given by God. The law was for a specific purpose, but that was not to deliver people from sin and grant salvation. Moses' law could show people the problem of sin. It could make them feel guilty. They could go through the various offerings for sin, but it could not ever completely deal with the sin problem. And the reason for that was, if you wanted to be just under the law, you had to keep the law perfectly. Jesus was able to do that. One source said it this way, the law went stumbling from crisis to crisis. Grace is sufficient for all things. I like that. The law was able to keep things going, but it was not going to be the solution like we have in Christ. Applied to today's time, if we have someone involved, and we're going to say this probably a couple more times in today's class and throughout the rest of the Galatian letter study, if somebody is involved in any other religion than the one true faith from God, you have a system which is weak, which is powerless, which is spiritually useless. And that includes following the Ten Commandments. Someone says, well, if you don't follow the Ten Commandments, you can do all the things that God prohibited. No, because you have 9 of the Ten Commandments in the New Testament, at least in some form. Thou shalt keep the Sabbath day is, of course, the only one that's not there. So if people go back and they try to follow the Sabbath to please God, it simply doesn't work. It is not a way for a man to be just. Anything you want to discuss before we make a couple more points? Tim?
Just makes you wonder how committed these people he's talking to, how committed they were to begin with. I mean, were they 100% in, or maybe 80%.
If you
hang out in some of the old ways.
Yeah, they were a little flaky. And you actually see that when you go back to the book of Acts. Paul shows up and, you know, one day he's a god to them, and a little later in the day they're ready to stone him. So it looks like there's some instability there that they really kind of can't make up the mind. It's, we want one foot in this camp and one foot in this camp, and whoever preaches the best message. There are people who are like that today. You know, they hear one thing and they believe this, and then they read something or see something, and all of a sudden their position changes, and then third thing happens, and then now they're over here, maybe back to position number one. And James talked about that as far as a person being unstable in all of his ways. And people can do that in the spiritual realm. They just kind of jump from religious group to religious group, and they never find a landing place, but that landing place needs to be the truth. Don?
Were these people, have pseudo-Christians come in and tell them this is what they had to do?
Yes.
Okay, so they were not coming from the old Jewish thing. They were stepping one step up, but they weren't stepping right.
It does look like they taught at least the basics about Christianity. I think they probably would have taught faith, repentance, confession, baptism, and maybe even some true things about worship. But if you truly wanted to be a mature Christian in Christ, the way for justification was to go back and pick up some elements of the Mosaic Law. And that's, I think, a helpful point for us when we think about spiritual danger, because people will say, you know, we got to follow the gospel, but we've also got some other stuff over here. Oftentimes that other stuff includes items from the Old Testament law, tithing being one example, or maybe things like candles in the Old Testament priesthood. And they try to adopt that stuff, bring that stuff into Christianity. That's the heart of the Galatian letter. And Paul says, you're severed from Christ. You know, Jesus, the New Testament system, that's all we need. Don't add anything to it. Don't subtract anything to it. Back to you.
Paul was a little hard on him, wasn't he?
He was a little hard?
Yeah, he didn't use a soft pillow.
He did. And it's not just one. I mean, he continues to whack him over the head. This is a fiery, this is a very strong letter. Remember how it begins. But though we are an angel from heaven should preach unto you any gospel other than what we preached unto you, let him be anathema. Let him be cut off from God. And I mean, he's not messing around with these people. He, as I said in one of the earlier classes, he puts on his war paint. And he goes on the warpath because this was a very, very serious matter. It's a great letter. It's a little hard to get through as far as some verses, but it is truly fantastic material. Brian?
Back in 2:4, it calls the teachers false brethren.
Yeah.
So those people are completely off. But this seems to be addressing the ones who are listening to them.
Yes.
That are on the path of
turning.
Turning.
Yes. Yes, exactly right. Very good. Anybody else? Don, back to you and then Mom.
Go ahead.
Mom, we'll take you first.
It just kind of reminds me of today. People have habits, like it could be drinking or smoking or drugs, and they quit. And then sometimes they go back to it unless they have somebody standing there with a whip or, you know, some stern language or some kind of encouragement to help them give up that habit and try to get back on the right track.
Yeah. There are people who need pulled back. There are also people who need yanked back. And Paul's done some pulling, but that may not be enough, so he's also doing some yanking. Don?
Mary has said that, but, you know, is Paul telling us, don't be soft-spoken people that are not following Christ?
Well, remember, Jude talked about snatching people out of the fire. If you think about taking somebody out of a house or, you know, who's injured, or there's a problem in the house, there are some times where people, maybe paramedics or the police, they show up and they're able to gently guide somebody out of the house. But there are other times where you have somebody who's like a firefighter, a house is on fire, and they, well, almost like Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, the angels grabbed, you know, Lot and his family and said, hey, you know, you guys got to come up. This place is going to get torched. And firefighters will have to sometimes almost rip people you know, away from a possession or maybe out of the arms of someone so another person can take the other family members. And spiritually, that's what you have sometimes in the religious realm. There are some people who, you know, need that come to Jesus meeting, so to speak, if they're going to be shaken loose from their sins. And that's really what the Galatians needed.
No, I just want to say that the Bible is our bad.
The Bible?
Well, if we want to give somebody on the right track, like Baptist,
yeah.
I'm in church, That's the ball right there.
It is, and we do the same thing with kids. There's some children who, with just a little correction, they get off track. A little correction will put them back on. Then you find that there are times where some other children, they really end up off the rails, and trying to get them back on the right path, you're looking at every tool in the toolbox. And, you know, from GPS monitoring to maybe involving authorities. So every situation is different. Sometimes a higher level of force is needed, and Paul's pulling out all the stops here.
Don's comment made me thinking about speaking the truth in love. And yes, he is whacking them over the head, as you say, with the baseball bat. But then in verse 12, he comes back and addresses them as brothers.
Brethren, yes.
Kind of like,
exactly right. He wants to be as kind as he can. So he's not trying to be mean. He's not trying to be cruel. But he is laying it on the line that they are doing a very bad thing. They're risking their spiritual well-being. So he wants to, as a loving father, would try to pull back the kids into the right way to do that as best as he can. Okay, let's go back and see what we've got as far as the word translated beggarly. That word meant poor, miserable, beggarly, impotent. It was a word which described the poor, and not just a description for the poor. It described those that were absolute, in absolute poverty. Here, I think you can see it in contrast to the riches of Christ. We've got the riches of Christ talked about in multiple books. And Paul's emphasizing, look, when you come to the pagan lifestyle, if you're going to live as a Greek, there are no spiritual riches there. That is not a spiritually wealthy way to live. And that's also pictured for the Jews. Judaism was not going to be a spiritually rich way. One source said weak because they have no spiritual power to strengthen us, beggarly because they have no rich promise like the gospel, rudiments because they belong to a rudimentary condition, to an undeveloped state, to the childhood of the race. I want to give you this quote from somebody who's traveled around the world as a missionary. He said he's seen the bondage of idolatry, and it really is. If you have never seen anyone or many involved with idolatry, he sort of sums it up pretty well. He says, I've seen people mutilate their bodies in an effort to pay homage to their gods. In Singapore, I saw Hindus stick metal rods into their backs and stomachs and cheeks, tongues and lips. These people were often bloody, in a trance, and in much pain. When you see things like this, or like Buddhists who burn hell money for their departed loved ones, you see people who are enslaved in the bondage of ignorance and superstition. Mark it down that with few exceptions, those nations who are steeped in idolatry today are in political and economic chaos. They make up the backward or third world nations. One of the things that makes America great is the fact that this nation was built by men and women who believe in the true and living God. Now, for us, for the most part, we're probably not going to see that kind of stuff in our lifetime. But we can see something that is perhaps a little parallel. If you look at some of the big cities, and even if you've not gone there, you can see the news reports as far as they've got the homeless encampments. You've got drug paraphernalia that's rampant. You have people walking around that are literally out of their minds. And it is a sad state. It's a sad place when you visit locations like that. And sometimes it can be a frightening thing. You find people who are still in spiritual bondage, aren't they? They're without God. Now, maybe they have some knowledge of the one true God. Maybe they've attended some kind of religious group in the past. Maybe they've even got a Bible in their homeless tent. So from a slightly different perspective, we can see the same kind of desperation and hopelessness in today's world. One other quick point, we'll see if you have anything to add or ask, then we'll take a look at verses 10 and 11. Paul, in this section specifically of Galatians, but really throughout the book, he emphasizes to the nth degree that you cannot acceptably combine New Testament Christianity with anything else. And that includes the law of Moses. If you try to take the gospel, Matthew through Revelation, and join it with anything or anyone else other than Christ, think about Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, there is none other name under heaven under which we may be saved, you are no better than someone who is practicing idolatry. Now that is going to be a hard message for a lot of people to hear in our day and time. If they've got a religious group which is not consistent with Scripture, if they want to follow parts of Moses' law, what we're looking at in Galatians chapter 4 says, you are no better off with your religious system than a heathen. That's going to upset some people. You want to talk about baseball bat teaching or theology? That's it. But that's what Paul is saying in this letter. And I think maybe that's why some people don't like the letter all that much. But Paul says you're going to be in spiritual bondage. You're going to be a child of the devil. You need the robes of righteousness through Christ and Christ alone. Remember from Revelation chapter 3 and verse 4, John said, through Jesus, you will be marked as worthy. You walk with me in right. You will walk with me in white. And then if you back up a chapter or two, Galatians chapter 2 and verse 21, Paul said, let's get that exact verse here. I do not make void the grace of God, for if righteousness is through the law, if you can go back and you can follow Moses' law, or you can follow the law generally for justification, he says Christ died for nothing. And that makes it very, very plain. It is either Jesus and Jesus alone for salvation or something else, and it results in condemnation. And that's the bottom line, really, in Galatians. That sums it up. Anything you want to add or ask before we move down a little more? Sherman, and then we'll look at verses 10 and 11 in Galatians 4.
Would this be kind of similar to someone that's so addicted to drugs or alcohol that they just can't get away from it? They had it, then they saw the light and got away, but they just went back.
Yeah, that would have been true for a lot of the Jewish converts. If you grow up, you've got this long history with Moses, the law, the feasts, everything Jewish. You've got the temple in Jerusalem. You think about Jesus' family. You know, they go there. The circumcision, age 12. You know, it's kind of a yearly pilgrimage. That's your culture. That's your life. That's your heritage. You have spent time in the synagogue. That's where you were trained. Maybe you had rabbinical training like Paul. I mean, God, as far as the Jewish faith, is the very centerpiece of your life. Then these Christians show up and say, well, that was good for a period of time. We've got a new system now. And you say, well, that's great. This Jesus, I want to follow him. I'll embrace his teachings. But you've still got all that Jewish baggage in your head. This would have been a real problem. This would have, and that's why from Romans chapter 14, we looked at that in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. We'll see that a little later. We get in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the eating of meats. There were some Jews that just could not be shaken loose from that, because that's what the pagans do, and we are we're a Christian, but really we're kind of a Jew. So it was a huge issue. And today we have the same kind of thing, only it's in a different form. People have some kind of addiction, they become a Christian, we've got this new life in Christ, but we've got so much baggage from the world that's pulling us back. That may be one of the reasons why you have athletic imagery in the New Testament. It encourages people to run the race, forgetting the things that are behind, trying to put those things in the past, plus an emphasis on repentance. Very good. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at verses 10 and 11, Galatians 4. Paul said, again, talking to these Christians, at least some of whom would have been Jewish converts, you observe days and months and seasons and years. I'm afraid for you, lest by any means I have bestowed labor on you in vain. If you go back to Moses' law, you find exactly the things that Paul talked about here. There were days to observe, of course. One of the big ones would have been the Sabbath day. There would have been months to year. There would have been months to observe, seasons and years to observe as well. When you look at that, and I think this is a correct observation, if you're going to teach people who have become Christians that they need to follow the Jewish laws, just like today, let's start with the today illustration. If you're going to teach kindergartners math, are you going to start with algebra and trigonometry?
No.
Probably not. I mean, math has changed some since I was in school, but I don't think that's where they begin. Where do you begin?
Basics.
You begin with the basics. You know, here's 1 plus 1, and here's 2 plus 2, and here's 3 times 3. If you're going to try to convince these people who have become Christians to follow things related to the Old Testament system, where do you want to begin? With the hard stuff or the easy stuff?
Easy.
You want to begin with the easy stuff. How easy would it be just to say, hey, there's some special times of the year, special times of the week, special times of the month that you want to observe? I mean, don't people like festivals? Sure. So if you're going to convince these people, if you're going to coax these people over to your side, this would be a very, very logical place to begin. So I think that's probably maybe not exactly where they begin, perhaps, but that would have been some of the initial teaching. When you look at the word which is translated observe, that's an interesting word for two reasons. First of all, it is expressed with the present tense. If I am teaching you to observe something ongoing, then I'm telling you this is something that you want to integrate into your life and make that a regular part of your life. The second thing is that that word has the sense of a strict or a rigid observance. Can you think of some things in life that people observe in a rigid way, a strict way? I mean, they follow this closely.
They,
well, okay, there's some people, they, you know, especially kids, I guess, they have that marked out. Probably several months in advance sometimes. What else? Strict adherence.
Morning coffee.
All right. There are some people, I mean, you know, don't talk to me before I get my coffee, right? Or if they're going to work or they're going to, you know, work around the house, that is their regimen. That's how they begin their day. Anything else? Strict adherence. Well, I'm thinking about, what about some people in manufacturing? If you've ever done, I mean, Tim, you're in manufacturing for a while. Tight tolerances sometimes. You got to be within, you know, these specs, you know. And people sometimes, I mean, if you're looking at the safety of people as far as a vehicle, if you're doing some things as far as medicine, you have to have strict observance. There are going to be some very, for lack of a better word, harsh protocols that you need to follow. Otherwise, death or injury may be the result. Gary?
We're pretty flexible about when we meet with family for holidays, but I've heard of some families that just have to meet on the holiday no matter what.
That's right. So these Galatians, very good illustration, these Galatians, they were giving scrupulous adherence to the Jewish calendar because of the apostates. Brian?
Romans 14, 5 and 6 throws observance of days as a personal preference or liberty issue. But here Paul seems to really make a big deal that there's something, that the way they were doing it is different than that. Maybe they were forcing it or something.
It could be. One has made this suggestion. This didn't come from me, but I really like it. He said that Paul wrote this letter when the Jews were observed, when these Jewish converts were observing a sabbatic year. I like that idea. And if that's true, then the force of this letter would be increased as far as this particular point. When you think about false teachers, one of the things that they often do is they're not out looking for converts. They want to go over to congregation A, B, or C and find some people that they can, siphon off. We saw that with a cult that showed up about 5 or 6 years ago. They were looking to grab some of our folks and make some new converts out of them. So the Judaizers who came to Galatia, they didn't come to convert them to Christ, came to convert them to their own ways, just like some cultists today. When you look at these special days here, again, I think that could have been the weekly Sabbath. There were also some feast days that could have fallen into that particular category. You have the months. That may have been a reference back to the new moons that you read about in Numbers chapter 28. The seasons could have been the three annual Jewish feasts, Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles, and the years could have been the sabbatic years. Well, Paul, going back to what I said earlier that I was going to repeat a couple times, if you follow those Jewish festivals, if you follow the Jewish calendars, does that really seem like it's adding to the gospel very much? I mean, does it take away from faith, repentance, confession, baptism? Nope. Does it take away from New Testament worship? Nope. All those things are still intact. You're simply saying, look, these were things that the Jews were involved with, and these are things that you can do too, and could they have done those things not for religious purposes as far as justification and been okay? Sure. But if you take those things and you begin to integrate them into your religion as far as part of the faith, now what have you done? You've added to the gospel. You've perverted the gospel. And then you deserve the condemnation that Paul smacked the Galatians with. So you also have this issue, which is perhaps even more serious. Paul sort of hints at it. We've done a lot of this as far as Sunday night some time ago. Remember those things that we have in the Old Testament, sometimes people, sometimes places. You've got the temple, you've got the tabernacle. All those items, they did what? As far as pointing forward to somebody. They pointed forward to Christ. You go back and you start looking at the Sabbath day. We've got a special day. Now it's the first day of the week. You start going back and you start looking at the various feasts, Passover, Pentecost. Those point forward to Christ. If you're telling people to observe those things, you're also sort of implying what? If those items pointed forward to Christ, and now you're telling people to observe these things for religious purposes, you're sort of implying that
reality isn't good enough.
Yeah, Jesus didn't come. The Messiah is not here. So this had some even bigger repercussions. Paul probably said more than enough to head these people back in the right direction, but if he had wanted to make that point, he could have done that as well. The only time that these Christians needed to observe was the first day of the week or Sunday, 1 Corinthians 16:2, New American Standard Translation. Tim, to you.
In 10 there, where it says you observe these days, months, and years, when he says you observe, he's saying you pay particular,
yes,
inordinate attention to these things here. And by doing that, you're paying less attention to what Christ said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the problem is. You're not paying attention to what the Son of God has said, which is the only thing that counts. And you're paying attention to what your neighbors and your buddies and
Moses.
Yeah. So, and that happens today. I mean, it happens all the time. Matter of fact, you got to say that
if a church isn't the Church of Christ, and I'm not talking about just with the name on the marquee out there, I'm talking about if they're not doing what Christ said do, then they're not his church. And if they're not his church, then they're in error. And if they're in error, then not good.
Yeah, that is right. That is exactly right. Going back to the days that we talked about, let's revisit a point that we've made a couple times since we have been involved in the book of Galatians. I said before that one of the appeals as far as the Old Testament system of religion was what? It's the same appeal that we find with individuals today.
It gives them direction.
Yes, and people can see it, and they can smell it, and they can touch it. It's that very fleshly kind of system where, I mean, people like benchmarks. If you're looking at the hours, for example, if you're working a 40-hour week, you can kind of count the days, you can count the hours and say, Friday is the last day of the week for me this week, not working any overtime, it's the 40th hour. Or we, you know, the last time that we hit the nail, we say, okay, now the job is finished. We like marks of completion. What would the days and the months and the seasons have given the Galatians?
Check marks.
Check marks. People love check marks to be able to say, we did it. We can have that same kind of mentality today. All right, you know, Sunday came, I went to services, I worshiped God, and I fulfilled my
duty.
You think there's some Christians who reason in that way? Sunday becomes a check mark. Well, God says, look, it's not about check marks. That was the Old Testament system. So that would have been one of the things, I think, just from a mental perspective, that would have been very, very appealing to the Galatians. Hey, look, you know, we observe Saturday, and we've got this special month, and all these other things, and it's kind of fun as well. Paul tells these Christians, as you look at verses 10 and 11, I am what for you? I am
afraid.
I'm afraid. Phobos. And what would you guess as far as the tense of that word? Past, present, future. It is present tense. He was really concerned. I think this was Luther way back when. He said, here we see the tears of Paul. And that is exactly right. You see, and Gary pointed this out earlier, he shows his love. He shows his concern for these saints. He wants them to realize, too, that they're not turning to something new. A lot of times people will try something or buy something or become interested in something because in their mind it's new. Paul's saying, look, this is not new. The pagans, they had their gods. The Jews, they had their system through Moses. And he started that back in 323. He ran that all the way through chapter 4 and verse 3. We talked about, Galatians 2:21, where Paul said that Jesus died in vain if you're not willing to live with the system that he's given. But the Galatians were still being influenced by these false teachers and apparently doing a great job. I'll tell you this to kind of sum things up a little bit. One source said the apostates began their false teaching with instruction on subjects like the Jewish calendar and circumcision and food restrictions. Perhaps they believed these matters were easier parts of Moses' law and best to begin with elementary instruction. That's why I gave you the math illustration earlier, and I think that is exactly right. Paul sees this, and he's trying to kind of unwind them from their beliefs. Now, it's, I guess, good from the standpoint that if you're going to try to teach somebody to follow Moses' law, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church has struggled with this a little bit. If you're going to convince somebody today to try to go back and follow the Old Testament law as it was given, how hard is that going to be? Is that going to be an easy thing or a difficult thing?
Difficult.
It's going to be tough. There's just really no way that you can replicate that. So the Adventists, they try to divide God's law in the Old Testament into the moral and the ceremonial. And they would say, well, those moral laws, we have to follow those. But on the other side of the fence, we have those ceremonial laws. We don't follow those today. And thankfully that caused some problems for the false teachers because this was not something that they could have easily taught as far as all the law to the people and probably not have gotten them convinced to follow anything or everything anyway. One source said, and I'll give you this quote too, I like it, he said, these verses ought to say something too to the Catholics and Protestants who are so caught up in the observance of days, months, seasons, and years. That to me seems to be another practical point. You have a lot of people who are so focused on those things. And for a lot of people, you probably have some friends that would say, I go to services when? If it is Easter, if it is
Christmas,
or maybe if it's Thanksgiving, that's when I go to services. That's when I attend, quote unquote, church. What are they doing? They're checking the boxes, aren't they? And in their mind, that is a good thing. Now, in the next chapter, and we'll skip over for just a second to Galatians chapter 5 and verse 10, let's see what Paul has to say. We know that he's got out the baseball bat here in Galatians chapter 4. But in 5:10, he says, I have confidence toward you in the Lord, that ye will be none otherwise minded, but he that troubleth you shall bear his judgment, whosoever he be. Things look pretty dismal in Galatians chapter 4, but when you look at 5:10, do you see sort of a shift in the thinking as far as Paul, or a shift in his focus on writing? Things are bad, Galatians 4, but in Galatians chapter 5, do I have hope for you? Do I think you're going to turn things around?
Yes.
Yes. So he is very, very serious as far as his tone in chapter 4. And back here, before we pick up with Galatians 4 and verse 12, he is concerned that he had bestowed labor on these Christians in vain. That word, which is translated labor, described oftentimes labor to the point of exhaustion. He had really invested a lot in these people, and he didn't want that labor to be lost. He didn't want that labor to be without result. When you look at that word, which is translated vain, it's also used back in Galatians chapter 3. Let's take a look at Galatians chapter 3 and verse 4 where it occurs. He says, did ye suffer so many things in vain? Now that's an interesting verse, because Paul says, when it comes to your faith, has it been an easy journey for you as far as living a Christian life? Did you suffer so many things in vain? Have there been some challenges to the Christian life? There had been. They had faced some very difficult things. And now Paul is asking them, are you going to throw it all away? Going back to the illustration that I began with, as far as a guy in the military, you get almost to the point of retirement. Are you really going to throw away your retirement pay, your health care, all the benefits that you would give, get from serving your country for 20 years? Is that really what you're going to trash? And that's what Paul is asking these Christians. Is it worth it to you to throw it all away? I hope not. So he's, again, doing everything he possibly can to encourage them to stick with Christ and the gospel. Anything that you want to add or ask before we highlight some things in verse 12? Don?
On Gary's check mark, I'm at fault when I say, I went to church on Sunday. I went to Bible study on Wednesday night. Did I really check mark? No, I didn't.
In our mind it is, but...
And talk to somebody else. I didn't check mark anything.
Yeah. I mean, it would be really nice if the Christian life were set up in that way, where God said, these are the boxes. I mean, it's just like other things in life. You take your car to the mechanic, and what's he do? There are 20 things that we're going to look at. We check all 20 boxes, and now you're good to go. We like a check life list. It's even eating. I had my coffee. I ate lunch. I ate breakfast. And, got a good night's rest. We live by checklists oftentimes. It's really easy to approach the spiritual life in the same way.
Pharisees were a lot like
yes.
They were so involved in keeping up appearances. They wanted everybody to see how righteous they were, when really inside here they weren't. They're just pretending.
Yeah, they had all the right clothing, that checked all the right boxes, and they tithed. When Jesus goes through and lists the various things that they tithe, I mean, it was like the smallest of herbs. You get down even to the seeds. We're going to tithe each one of those. And we check the boxes, therefore we are in a right relationship with God. And Jesus said, you're like a dirty cup. Clean on the outside, but filthy on the inside. But people like a check mark religion. And Galatians says that will not work. All right, that it? We'll pick up verse 12 next time, Lord willing. Thank you.